For those of you who are just joining us, this is Chris Atwood, and I have on the phone Janet Atwood, the co-host who is doing the interview and introducing our guest tonight. I want to let you all know that Janet is calling in from Kerala, India, and so if it should happen that she drops out at any point during the call, you'll understand as she says, welcome to India. So, Janet, I'd like to turn it over to you now.
Great. Thanks, Chris. And I'll tell you all, I am so excited about this call tonight. So welcome, welcome to the Passions of Real Life Legends. As you all know, my name is Janet Atwood. I'm the cover editor for Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise and author of The Passion Test, Discovering Your Personal Secrets to Living a Life on Fire. And for those of you who are joining us for the first time, this series is an opportunity for you to learn what you need to do to discover your passions and live your personal destiny by hearing from people who have been incredibly successful at doing that in their own lives. I want to begin first by congratulating each and every one of you for being on this call. You know, there are so many other things you could have been doing, yet you have the commitment to yourself and to the world to discover your passions and give your gifts. You know, what I'm seeing on every single call as I'm speaking to you is that you are all unique, and there's no one else on the planet who has the gifts which you have. And when you discover and give those gifts, then everyone benefits. And by taking the time to be on these calls, you're giving yourself the chance to learn from some of the most successful people in the world about what it takes to live a passionate life. A few weeks ago, Steve Jobs gave the commencement address at Stanford, and during this talk he said, "The only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking. Don't settle. As with all matters of the heart, you'll know when you find it. And like any great relationship, it just gets better and better as the years roll on. So keep looking until you find it. Don't settle." With that, it's my great pleasure to introduce our guest on tonight's call and my co-host, Bobby Roth, who will conduct tonight's interview. David Lynch is a Renaissance man of modern America filmmaking, an acclaimed and widely recognized writer-director, as well as television producer, photographer, cartoonist, composer, and graphic artist. While considered by many an art house director, he has gained great mass acceptance and won numerous awards for his work. David has created a style so visionary and deeply personal that the phrase Lynchian has been coined to describe it. David's first feature film, Eraserhead, became a cult classic. He has been nominated twice for Academy Awards as Best Director, first for The Elephant Man, and later for Blue Velvet. His film, Wild at Heart, received the coveted Palme d'Or at Cannes in 1990, and he was awarded the Cannes Festival Award for Best Director in 2001 for Mulholland Drive. Likewise, his television series Twin Peaks was a cultural phenomenon and put him on the cover of Time magazine. In recent years, David's public appearances have focused on his inner journey as he appeared numerous times to support the programs for education and world peace offered by His Holiness Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who brought transcendental meditation to the West, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that tonight. Tonight, I am honored to have with me Robert Roth, my great friend and co-host, who will conduct our interview with David. Bobby is the Director of Media Relations for the Institute of Science, Technology, and Public Policy, and is the author of the definitive book on Transcendental Meditation. If you want to learn something about the remarkable work that Bobby does, go to www.permanentpeace.org. That's www.permanentpeace.org. Bobby, thanks so much for joining us. I'm so happy to be with you tonight. I'm stuttering as I say tonight because it's almost 6 o'clock in the morning for me. And I'll turn it over to you so you can interview our great and illustrious guest.
Thank you so much, Janet. That was a very beautiful introduction, and you sound remarkably clear and remarkably awake for being on the other side of the world in India. But as all the listeners on this program and the people who followed you know, you are an extraordinarily bright and wise soul and a very dear friend of mine. So I'm very happy and honored to be doing this interview and also to pose these questions to an incredibly close friend of mine, and I'm very honored to say that, David Lynch. David, we have 3,675 questions. No, I'm just kidding. We have 15 questions here, And we have an hour and about a little over an hour. And we're very grateful that you're taking the time to talk with all of us on this call and on this webcast. And so I'd like to begin right away with the first question. David, you have been called a pop surrealist master and, quote, the Renaissance man of modern American filmmaking. On the other hand, Roger Ebert has said, quote, there is something inside of me that resists the films of David Lynch, close quote. Your films clearly evoke a wide range of responses. What is the passion in your life which has given rise to the unique and unusual work you have created?
How you doing, Bobby?
I'm great, and it's wonderful to hear your voice for the second time today, David.
Right, and I want to thank Janet for those kind words and say hello to everybody on the line.
And David, before we start, I just want you to know, Elephant Man, one of my all-time, if not all-time, favorite movies in the world, so I am so, so excited. I'm jumping up and down here in India.
And before he even gets to talk, the listeners are just going to be charmed by David's... Anyway, David, you go ahead.
Well, I... You know, it's difficult to answer that question. I started out just as a regular person, and I liked to paint and I liked to draw. And I grew up in the Northwest, and I sort of thought wrongly that when you got to be an adult, you stopped painting and drawing and did something, you know, more serious. But in the ninth grade, my family moved to Alexandria, Virginia. And on the front lawn one night of my girlfriend's house, I met a guy named Toby Keeler. And as we were talking, he said his father was a painter. And I thought maybe he might have been a house painter. But further talking got me around to the fact that he was a fine artist. And this conversation changed my life, and I was interested in science somewhat, and I suddenly knew that I wanted to be a painter. So I started out in painting, and the thing is, like everybody knows who's on the line here for sure, that we all have a voice, and it's just a question of working. And as you work, you know, the more you work, the more it just kind of comes out. It's not something I don't think that can really be taught. It just comes out, and you want your own voice to come out in a kind of freedom. And I lucked into filmmaking, really. I made a moving painting when I was at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, and a guy saw this and commissioned me to make another. And my camera was broken, so I made a kind of a live-action and animation combo, which he said he would like, and that led me to get a grant from the American Film Institute. So in filmmaking, I came in through painting, I just got green lights, and I didn't really know anything, and I really believe that by doing, things come out, and you just have to be true to yourself, and keep that voice going. And it's like that. And then you realize very quickly that not everybody loves what you do. So the doing should be enjoyable. And one of the things that you can test that is you would do it whether you got paid or not. It's just fantastically enjoyable. So, but when a thing is finished and you release it into the world, you never know what's going to happen. And if you've enjoyed the doing and you get bad reviews, you can still live with it. If you sell out and you get bad reviews, it's very, very, very tough.
So when you sent out Mulholland Drive, when you sent out Elephant Man, you had no sort of indication what the response was going to be? It was just completely just sending it off into the unknown?
Well, you have some indication from the number of people that have seen it before you actually do a release, but that can be misleading. There have been stories of films that have gotten great previews and then go on to be huge failures. So you never really know how people will take to something.
Great. The follow-up question that I have here, was there anything you talked about your friend, whose father was not a house painter and these different things? Could you isolate specifically how you discovered the personal passions which gave rise to your masterpieces, or was it just random? What was it? Just starting and doing?
Always, like Janet said, it's what you love to do. And sometimes I know there are people out there who love making films or love making paintings, but like they say, they can't get arrested. They just don't have a gallery dealer, who likes their work, or they haven't gotten a green light into, film companies. And that's a tough road. But if you love what you're doing, you're going to keep on doing it anyway. And so I'd say I've been very lucky. But and then along the way, there are people that help us. And I've had, plenty of those people in my life who've, help me go to the next step. And but you get that help because you've done something, and it kind of goes like that.
So your idea, luck, good fortune, that really gets driven by sort of your passion, your persistence, and your conviction to just do, and then you sort of have to have the hope or with the conviction that good things will come your way.
Exactly. You have hope. But you would love the doing so much, you're kind of constantly working.
I have to tell everybody on this call, and I think great credit for this goes to Janet and Chris, David Lynch doesn't talk this much. You're very comfortable. This is great. I mean, I have to tell the story. David received an award in Los Angeles, Janet, and he was so uncomfortable about getting up to receive the award in front of this big crowd of people that he stood up at the podium and he brought a tape recorder and he turned on a tape recorder. He had taped a message, his acceptance speech, and he put the microphone. So this is a wonderful forum. I'm here finding out more than I ever knew. Next question. You are not only a filmmaker, you are also a photographer, a cartoonist, a composer, and a graphic artist. What was the driving force which led you to express yourself in so many different ways?
Painting led me to film, and they say filmmaking combines, the most kind of avenues of art. And so you kind of get interested in photography, for instance. And photography is incredibly fantastic, and like all these avenues are infinitely deep. So you start taking photographs and you start looking at them and realizing certain things, taking more, and off you go into the world of photography, which is just as deep as the world of painting or the world of film. And I don't know where the cartoons came, but certain things strike as funny, and ideas drive the boat. So once in a while, when we're lucky, we get some ideas. And ideas are so magical because they bring with it a kind of a spark, inspirational spark, tremendous energy. You see the thing, and you're off running doing it. So all the different avenues just have been sparked by ideas, and they're thrilling, or else you wouldn't do them. So cartoons came out of ideas, photography came out of film, really. Music came out of film. Working with the great Angelo Badalamenti, I'd always been interested in sound, but Angelo, I always say, brought me into the world of music. And all these avenues, once you start down, you just get more and more and more thrilled along the way.
Can you
Hello?
Hear me? Yeah, that was, I was on mute so that you didn't have to hear me cough.
Keep meditation, huh?
Yeah. Bobby's gone off now.
No, Bobby's here. Bobby's just dumbfounded. Do you have any one of these areas? Would you say film is your deepest passion?
Well,
you know,
film is the main thing.
Is it the money maker or is it the main passion?
I love all the avenues. But film is the main thing, and it opens up the biggest world, and it involves time, like music, and sequences, and abstractions. Cinema can say abstractions, and that's what I love about it. I like a kind of a somewhat of a realistic story that holds abstractions. And that's what I think, you know, film can do so beautifully. And that's what I love, to go into a world and pretty much get lost.
It's beautiful answers. These are beautiful answers. Before I go into the next question about your film, I have one follow-up question on, you talked about film and abstractions, but I read where you're now moving away, it's a bit of a technical question, but you're moving away from film and you're going to digital video, which has been, I thought some people said, well, you lose some of the abstraction when you use, is that correct?
No.
Oh, okay. It's correct you're doing digital video.
It's correct,
okay.
I'm doing DV.
Yeah.
And I would say, you never say never, but right now I would say I'll never shoot film again. And the reason is I don't mind a little loss of quality for the other things you get from DV. It's a fantastically light and fluid medium. And when you look at a picture, you look at the feel of the moving image, your ideas start, you know, going with that. The cameras are small. The takes are 40 minutes long. All the equipment is small. And you can light a scene with, you know, less people and less, you know, giant lamps. And actors, for instance, love this. I can be just talking away to them, never stop the camera, move here, move there, move around here, move around there, and keep it going. And they just get deeper and deeper into it. It's the most beautiful thing for me. And film, you just die in between takes. It takes so long to light a thing. The cameras weigh tons. Everything is huge, and it's a slow kind of plodding death.
Now, if any of the listeners ever wanted to bottle passion, this David Lynch's voice, and it's just going to keep building because as we get more along this, a few more questions on this, and then your meditation, everything. You font of passion is the definition of it, the embodiment. Next question. And some of these questions I want the listeners to know have been beautifully crafted by Chris Atwood. One reviewer has said, quote, "More than any other art house filmmaker of his era, David Lynch has enjoyed considerable mass acceptance and has helped to redefine commercial tastes." Close quote. David, how have you been able to remain true to yourself and your own passions, and yet still create works which appeal to a mass audience?
There's no way to answer that. In the world of film, more and more, a director is, this is speaking very generally, the director is a hired hand.
Oh.
And a lot of directors don't have final cut on their films. And this, to me, is an absurdity.
They don't have final cut on their films?
But this is the way it is. And many of the decisions for a final film are made by committee. Now, I'm talking generally. It's not always
like
the case,
like,
but it's
Disney
drifting in that direction.
Uh-huh.
And if a painter finishes a painting, there's no bunch of people that come in and say they don't like this blue or they don't like that and you got to change this. Filmmaking should, in my opinion, be exactly that. And the director is the filmmaker. yes, he's got plenty of help along the way. And one of the rules is you never turn down a good idea, but you never take a bad idea. And you're the filter through which all these ideas pass. And you have to have that follow-through of one vision for the thing to hold together. And so you just stay true to that. Stay true to the ideas. And like we were saying, the idea comes pretty complete, but it's a seed. It's a seed. And as you go, you keep checking back and seeing if it's true to that original idea, and stay true to that as you go along. And new ideas can come in, but then you have to decide if those marry to the thing and they make it better, or they just don't fit in this one, and you put that idea in a little box. And you march through feeling it. It's got to feel correct, every element. And then it has a chance of holding together. But what happens afterwards, like I said, you cannot control. So there are some people who stay really true to their voice, and they get into theaters, and people don't like what they've done. Now, maybe they luck out, and 10 years later, people come around to loving it. And this happens in painting all the time. But in film, you've got to stay true to yourself. You've got to stay true to your voice. And then you have at least a chance of being able to live with yourself.
Were you always this way, even as a child growing up in Montana, as a Boy Scout, Eagle Scout, and all the different things that you've been doing? Have you always been this sort of vigilant on your own inner voice and being true to yourself?
I never really thought about it. You realize that you are vigilant when something starts coming around to fiddle with it. And then all these signals go off. And you realize that you're in a place where you have to hang tough. And if you don't, if you sell out, that's the real painful death.
Whew. You have a very loud inner voice, David. It's the last question along this line of thinking here, this discussion is, what advice would you give to the thousands and thousands of listeners and readers of Healthy and Wise that would help them walk a tightrope in their own lives between being true to their own passions and yet being able to affect the masses of people?
Well, I think the thing to do is, like Janet was saying, find that thing that you love. And when you find that thing that you love, there's just no problem. You do that, and wherever you start along that path, you learn things by doing, and the thing grows. It just gets better. You teach yourself by doing, and you stay true to that, and everything could be just fine. But if something comes along that forces you to alter your voice, you will feel it, and then you will tell that person to go away.
That's what you do regularly with me.
Yes, don't rain on my parade, and then you go like that. It doesn't mean that you're going to have a success in terms of money, but you'll have a success in experience, and that's worth a tremendous amount.
Did you ever sacrifice anything, something that was most important to you?
Yes, on my film Dune, I sold out.
How did you do that?
Well, I didn't have Final Cut, and I realized that I was adjusting things, and I love Dino De Laurentiis and Rafaela, his daughter, who were both producers on the film. I realized I was adjusting things because I didn't have the final say. I was adjusting things right from the get-go. So Dune was a huge failure for me, and even though I knew these things up front, I still let myself get into this, and I paid the price. So it just nailed down that lesson once and for all.
Well, this is a beautiful follow-up question from Chris. some of these questions are mine, some of them are Chris's, but they're so beautiful from Chris. Are there pressures on someone in your position, I guess, film, you just mentioned it, to let go of your passions, to give up the things that are most important to you? And how do you deal with that pressure? Just stand, I mean, how do you deal when the same thing comes up now? How do you deal with that?
Well, there are pressures always. And but if you are lucky, you will work with people that want your voice, that don't want to fiddle with that voice, and that, you know, fight anyone or anything that comes along that would hurt that. So I didn't have final cut on The Elephant Man, but Mel Brooks, in effect, fought many battles on my behalf to let the film be, you know, what I wanted it to be. And if you can tell right from the beginning, well begun is half done. If you're in with the wrong people, if you get a bad feeling, chances are you're correct. And you've got to get into a situation where you feel that you'll be able to keep your voice throughout the whole project.
That's why you said to me that you've been offered many times to be a director in a, you know, for a what you would call a company like a Sony or something. You've always turned that down?
Well, no, I haven't been offered so many times because my films don't make a truckload of money. But I have been offered some, and I've talked with people at studios, and, you know, a lot of times they say, no, we're not going to give you, you know, a final cut. Which, you know, then you just leave the office as quickly as possible.
I just can't imagine. I had no idea that you would work on a film, or that anybody could work on a film, invest their life into it, their passions, and then turn it over to someone else. I know I'm in journalism, and I know that what happens with Time Magazine is people will, reporters in the field will collect information, they'll do interviews, and then they send it off to an editor in New York who hasn't met any of the people. They just collect all the information and they just write whatever they want to write. I had no idea it was the same with some of these. That's how these big budget films are done?
I've never done one, so.
You heard?
I hear things, and, like I said, I think generally, you know, it's very tough to stay away from the power of the studio, especially at near the end of a film. If they're not getting, you know, these rave reviews or, you know, rave cards and previews, they'll start fiddling with the picture.
Well, they're not always successful because there's been a lot of high money busts out there.
Absolutely. And you can't turn a sow's ear into a silk purse a lot of times.
That was good. I like that one, David. That was... Okay, we're going to shift gears for a moment. You have appeared publicly during the past few years supporting the programs created by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi for education in the schools and world peace. And you've heard this question before. Your work is often referred to as dark or surreal, and yet these meditation-based programs seem to be distinctly the opposite. What has driven you to make such a seemingly, you know, dramatic shift to support these programs?
Well, I started Maharishi's Transcendental Meditation during my first feature film, Eraserhead. And I would, for the 2 years before that, started looking into meditation and reading and asking questions. And something about what my sister said about transcendental meditation, because she had started 6 months earlier, something in her voice, something she said, I said, I want that. And I stopped looking at any other form of meditation, and I went and I started. And the thing is that you don't have to be a certain way to be a meditator. You just become more and more yourself, and you get happier and happier, and you enjoy the doing more and more. And fears and anxieties, and in my case, anger as well, suddenly start disappearing. It is the greatest thing for a filmmaker to slowly not be so affected by the pressures and the stress and all this and have this inner happiness that just takes you through the most difficult situations. Meditation is money in the bank. No two ways about it. Now, when you make a film, you get excited about certain ideas. Maharishi doesn't tell you, don't get excited about this idea, don't get excited about that idea, get excited about this idea, nothing like this. You get excited about what you get excited about. Right or wrong, you do. And then you go to work. And a lot of films, filmmakers, you know, books, you know, paintings reflect the world we live in. And there it is, the world, and ideas come out of that. And these stories come out of that. And if the world were to change, I think all the ideas and the films and the books and all these things would change. I don't think it's wrong to have much negativity or struggle or all kinds of things in a film. What's wrong is to have all this negativity and struggle and stress and negativity in life. So, I love, you know, what happened after I started, you know, Transcendental Meditation. And I think since, Transcendental Meditation, Maharishi's gift to the world is to dive within all the way in and experience this field of unity, which is pure creativity, where creativity comes from. To experience that for an artist is the greatest thing. We want to catch ideas. We want to get inspiration. We want to be, you know, creative. And that's the ocean of creativity and the ocean of bliss, intelligence, consciousness, love, energy. It's not a laid back, you know, sort of thing. It's filled with energy, this unified field that you dive into. So I love it, and just recently, on July 1st, had my 32nd anniversary of meditation, and I've never missed a meditation in those 32 years.
Why have you not missed a meditation?
I don't know, Bobby. When I started, I just wanted to do it, and I wanted to do it, you know, the way I was taught, and I love diving within. So I guess I've been lucky that I've always found a place to meditate, always got, you know, the time to do it, and so there it is.
How would you be a different director than you are today? Two questions. First, as a person, but as a director. How would you be a different director today were it not for your practice of Transcendental Meditation?
I would be much more uptight. I'd be more easily angered. I'd be more distrustful of people. I'd be more paranoid. I'd be more tired. I wouldn't be as happy inside. I wouldn't be able to catch deeper ideas. I wouldn't have so much intuition. And I could go on and on and on.
Describe intuition.
Intuition to me is one of the great things that grows by contacting this unified field, divine being within. It's a combo of feeling and thinking at the same time. It's a kind of knowingness. And this knowingness, everybody experiences this, you know, but it grows by diving into that, you know, field. And so you can feel a thing being correct. And this is such a tool in film or painting or music or anything. It's a kind of knowing.
I just got into your question. Now, then the other question on that is passion. How would you define, how does David Lynch define the experience? Just passion. What is passion to you?
Well, passion is a small dog going by a chocolate shop. First starts smelling that chocolate, then speeding up, you see the smile on the dog's face, and in he goes.
Janet, how'd you like that from India?
You know, as we said in the very beginning, David is a unique, so There you have it.
Isn't he the greatest?
I'm going to have to really sit with that definition
it's
for a while.
He's just the greatest. He's just the greatest. Okay. Describe how you talked about a capture. Unfortunately, I keep thinking it was a little dog. Do you want to describe the dog? Was it a little pooch? Was it a big dog?
It was a golden retriever.
I just see this little dog just sort of hustling into this cornered chocolate store with a chocoholic addiction, this little dog. Okay. Meditation, transcendental meditation. You described something to me. You said when you were making Mulholland Drive, and if people don't know that, you go online and you see all the awards Mulholland Drive received. I mean, first of all, David has been nominated 3 times for Academy Award as Best Film Director.
I think only twice for Best Film.
Oh, the other one was for writing.
No, that's true.
No, three
times.
Hey, I know.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, three.
Right.
And then once for writing, I think.
Right.
Yeah, see, I know. Anyway, you said that when you made Mulholland Drive, it was really going to be a television series, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and it was going to go in many different directions, like Twin Peaks. And then, by the way, I have a friend of mine who just started meditation, who's such a devotee of David Lynch. She has seen the entire Twin Peaks series 100 times, and she's only 22 years old. Anyway, I said,
you should get out and...
She's a little fresh air.
To work.
No, but she's actually going to teach art. She's a very successful woman. Anyway, you said it was going in a million different directions. Now, all of it, because it had no resolution, and now all of a sudden you're going to have to tie it all together, much to the frustration of most viewers, to make a film. And you didn't know what to do, and you said the solution came during meditation. Now, I know meditation, the purpose, because I practice transcendental meditation, it's not to arrive at any particular conclusion or have any particular thought during the process, but you said something came of the result of that tied it together. Could you describe how all this diversity got unified from your practice of TM?
Well, like you said, Mulholland Drive started out being a television pilot, and a pilot is supposed to be open-ended. So that, people seeing the pilot become very interested in the characters and the possibilities, and they want to see it next week and the week after, like that. So when it came time when the deal was completed to make it into a feature, I didn't have the ideas to make it into a feature. And that was a kind of a traumatic time. And one night...
How so? What was the experience of the trauma?
The experience was, what am I going to do? And I need ideas. And I'd had quite some time to, think about it, so maybe somewhere it was all being kind of thought about. But if you were to ask me what I was going to do, I wouldn't know. But I sat down to meditate one night, and about halfway through, these ideas started just racing out. And I wrote those down because if you don't write an idea down and you forget it, that is just sort of unforgivable. And so you write them down, and I wrote them down, and there was solution to putting it into a finished, complete feature film that came almost all of it at once.
And why did that happen?
I don't know, Bobby. They just came out, and I see it as a gift.
One of the interesting things in listening to this discussion is the two things that really, or three things that stand out, is that you're a man of great truthfulness and conviction to your own truth, and that you love ideas, and the more abstract the idea, the better. I remember watching a videotape of a press conference, actually, and we're about to talk about Maharshi. Maharshi was giving a press conference, and maybe the reason why I consider David such a good friend is in many ways we're complete opposites. I mean, I'm like practical, point value. Does everybody understand it? So I sort of sidled over to David, and I said, David, don't you think this is kind of an abstract answer that Maharshi's giving to the press? And he got this giant smile on his face, and he said, I love abstraction. I never forgot that. Okay, you learned transcendental meditation. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, many people have heard of Maharishi. They may not know much about him. They, oh, the Beatles or Merv Griffin, or it's been around for 50 years. People don't really know who Maharishi is. Millions of people have learned the technique of all religions and all that sort of thing, but there's not a nature, you know, a person, not a personality so much, but a feeling or a nature about who Maharishi is. It's more of a name or a picture or something you've heard about in the past. From your experience, who is Maharishi? What is he like? What is your experience with Maharishi? Why do you have such a conviction about him and what he's doing that you would stand up boldly in support of his programs? That was about 14 questions. The first question is, who is Maharishi from your experience?
You know, I don't know Maharishi personally, really. But Maharishi is a holy man. And they say one definition of a holy man is a man who is whole, W-H-O-L-E, complete. And Maharishi, there could be holy men who don't teach a way for others to become holy men. And Maharishi teaches transcendental meditation, which it's a simple, easy, effortless, but supremely profound technique that takes you within. And all our senses are pointed out, and transcendental meditation turns the mind within, and you experience subtler levels of mind and intellect and transcend and experience this field of unity, oneness, that modern science calls the unified field, because they discovered the same field 30 years ago. Now, if you went out onto the street and asked somebody, please tell me about the unified field and how do I get there, you wouldn't get an answer. Maharishi, it's so beautiful and so fantastic that this exists, a way to dive within and experience this field. And it's not an intellectual thing, it's an experience. And as you know, Bobby, that's the only experience that lights the whole brain on the EEG machine. It's a holistic experience. It takes the full brain to experience the field of unity. Who can teach this? Who can, out there in the world, ask George Bush if he can tell you how to transcend and experience the ultimate reality? It's a huge thing. And Maharishi has been going around tirelessly teaching and trying to help, you know, individuals and the world for 50 years. Night and day, almost 24/7, hardly sleeps, and for people, for the world.
I'm going to interrupt just for a moment and let you go on. I know you're in the midst of passion. You say the word holy man. People could think, well, I'm a Christian, I'm a Buddhist, I already have a religion. Is Maharishi your religious leader?
It's like they say, it's, you know, I, for me, all the great religions are like rivers. And every one of these rivers is beautiful. And they all flow to the same ocean. So everything is fine. And transcendental meditation takes you to the ocean. And that's the whole, you know, thing. It's the unified field. It's rather large. It's unbounded, infinite, and eternal. It's that field that is the kingdom of heaven. It never had a beginning. It is, and it will always be. And modern science, bless their hearts, have now verified what Maharishi's Vedic science has been saying all along. Veda means pertaining to total knowledge. The Vedas are the laws of nature which exist in the field of unity, unified field, and it's an eternal science. Transcendental meditation is an ancient, ancient technique. And this is all part of a human thing. It's a natural thing. It's our home. It's where we're all spun out of pure consciousness which exists there. It's our home. You're just diving within and experience what they call Atma, the self, and that's the big self of us all. And once you start experiencing that, things start getting better. And, the experience enlivens it, unfolds it, it grows, and things get better. Negativity, like darkness, can't live in the light of this unity, like darkness can't live in bright light. It makes so much sense to me. I don't know why everybody isn't meditating, and it brings so much happiness and a multitude of benefits.
Well, it is true. I practice transcendental meditation, and people of all religions do it, and it's the common experience that everyone has. We've heard the lines, "Be still and know that I am God, kingdom of heaven is within." Every religion, every great philosopher, every great poet, every great writer has all talked about this ocean of consciousness within. And the transcendental meditation is that revival or return of a simple practice that had to be there at all times, at different times in culture, every culture, of just quietly the mind and body settling down and, as David said, diving within and experiencing that ocean of consciousness.
Another thing, Maharishi has, you know, has kept the same, you know, message, just expanded it and expanded it and expanded it through the 50 years. He's got such a great sense of humor and can be a very stern father at the same time, can be like a child, and it's like listening to him speak to me and seeing him is like sitting next to the fireplace with your favorite people. It's a beautiful thing. The more of that being, you know, the absolute, the unified field we have, the more people like being around it, like being around you. Just like people do not like being around someone who's super depressed or super angry, it's the reverse of that. And that's the proof that something beautiful is going on.
What experience would you say, from your experience with Maharishi, then we'll move on, but your experience with, what have you taken from that? Because I know you just spent some time in Holland just a little while ago. You were over there where Maharishi is in the forest out there in Holland where he has his headquarters. What was that experience like?
Well, what it's like is being around someone that is completely filled with everything it takes, and so blissful. It's a unique thing. I think you know it when you see it, and it's. I think that the thing is, I would like to be that way, and I think, you know, enlightenment is the full potential of each human being, and they say it's our birthright to enjoy enlightenment. And the way you get it is to, you know, get so familiar with the unified field, get so filled with that, and it's enlightenment, they say, is a state described as more than the most. It's there in Maharishi, and there's no two ways about it.
I just would like to add, and then we'll go on to the next question, is that I think Maharishi sees that in you, because I happen to know in all of Maharishi's interactions with you that Maharishi holds you in enormous respect for your creativity, for your honesty, for your boldness. I think that enlightenment respects and appreciates growing enlightenment, so I think it's... And people can hear it in the passion, in your distinct individuality.
I'm not enlightened, but I'm growing in that.
No,
and
I know.
And the way you grow more quickly is to take on this technique that allows you to dive within, which is a great, great, you know, super gift that Maharishi's brought.
Now, you were in Washington, D.C. recently. There was a press conference that was held. Actually, several times you've been in Washington, D.C. Before I go to that, I want to ask you about your foundation. You've established, we're going to talk about world peace, but first I want to talk to you about education, then we have a couple of final questions. You have established, actually July 21st is going to be legally established, the David Lynch Foundation for Consciousness-Based Education and World Peace. And I know that the listeners have been told that they can go to www.davidlynchfoundation.com, davidlynchfoundation.com, to find out more about it, the beautiful website. You're launching on a campaign to raise money and to give money to offer transcendental meditation to any child in America who wants to meditate. Why are you doing this?
I'm doing this because, number one, I think everybody has realized or is, you know, quickly realizing that education, at least in America, is very poor. And there, it's happened kind of gradually, and it maybe wasn't so great to begin with, but it's gotten worse and worse, but so gradually that people kind of accept it. And everyone wants to change it, but they don't know quite what to do. And it just keeps getting worse, and more private schools are popping up, and even those schools, don't fully educate a child, and there's all kinds of rising stress going on, and many, many problems we all know about in the schools. Consciousness-based education, I visited Maharishi University of Management and the high school. What's the name of the high school?
Maharishi School.
Maharishi School. And I saw a play. And I remember it was a rainy, cold night. And it's a tiny little theater, but the theater was packed. And I sat there thinking, this is going to be such a boring evening.
I remember you were sitting sort of not on the aisle.
I was in the middle. There was no way I could leave.
You couldn't crawl out.
And I'm going to see a high school play. So I started watching this thing, and literally in maybe 15 seconds, I realized this wasn't going to be boring. And then it just got better and better. I saw things on that stage that I couldn't believe. I saw a level of intelligence and a kind of a consciousness just beaming off these students who weren't actors but were doing incredible things. So creative was the play, so great was every person, and it just pulled me in. And I said, what in the world is going on? I've never seen a thing like that. And afterwards, I thought, every actor has got to start, you know, meditation. It puts a thing on the screen or on a stage that is really incredible. It's a thing you just are pulled into. And the intelligence coming off of the timing of this thing and the humor of the things, it was so beautiful. And I come to realize that consciousness-based education is education that where students learn, you know, transcendental meditation, they learn to dive within, and they learn about the knower, and then they can learn about the object of knowledge. And right now, most schools are just avenues of knowledge and no knowledge of the knower, the self. And they say it's like learning about the rays of the sun, all the different avenues that we learn in school, but not about the sun itself. You just add this element to school, and every time it's done, the students just blossom. All the problems that they've had in the schools where they've introduced this consciousness-based education, the problems go away. And the students blossom. And they get great, fantastic grades, and they're not just, you know, book, you know, nuts. They are, you know, in every single avenue they blossom. So I wanted to, you know, help get that going. That's how come the consciousness-based education. And then this ties in, as you know, to world peace as well.
Well, I would just like to add here that when you look on the website, you'll see that there's been programs in inner city schools in Washington, D.C. and Detroit, and research has been conducted on the meditating school kids, for example, by the University of Michigan, and they found that these kids at this school, inner city school in Detroit, have reduced depression, better grades, get along better with each other. There's other studies that have shown higher grade point averages, improvements with learning kids with learning disorders, ADHD, in Washington, D.C. And in Fairfield, the school you were talking about, Marshy School, that school for 15 consecutive years has scored in the top 99th percentile of the country in national standardized tests, and they have 10 times the national average for national merit scholars. So it is an extraordinary school, and I think an example of what can happen when children get a chance to just develop who they are inside.
Exactly right.
There's someone that's not on mute. Maybe that's Janet in the... Maybe that's the noise of India, something in the background there. But
it's a beautiful noise.
It's a beautiful noise. I have two final questions for you. At Healthy, at Healthy and Wise, we believe strongly in the power of intention to manifest outcomes. I think everybody on this call subscribes to that, the power of intention to manifest outcomes. What is your biggest current project? And what intention would you like us at Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, along with our readers and listeners, to hold for you? What kind of support would you like us to give you?
Well, that's beautiful. Maharishi says, where the attention is, that becomes lively. And I see that as kind of like a focus. What you're focusing on, that, for instance, ideas, when you focus, the focusing is like a bait on a hook. And the ideas are like fish. So if your focus is good enough, the fish will come in. And the deeper fish, the deeper the water, the bigger the fish. So when you add meditation to your life, you start getting a bigger, reach to the big fish. And right now I'm working on a film called Inland Empire. And I've never worked on a project in this way before. I don't know exactly how this thing will finally unfold. And if people want to help me in focusing, that would be incredibly beautiful. And maybe I'll get that one last big fish to swim in.
What do you mean you don't, without going into details, because I know you don't want to talk about the film, but just say, how is this film different? You're following your passion. How is this different than other films? Like, let's say Mulholland Drive or Janet's favorite, Elephant Man.
This film is very different because I don't have a script. I write the thing scene by scene, and much of it is shot, and I don't have much of a clue where it will end. So it's a risk, but I have this feeling that because all things are unified, that this idea over here in that room will somehow relate to that idea over there in the pink room.
Do you think that all, and I'm going to put you in your humility, but do you think that all great artists, all great scientists, all great thinkers share the sort of this, they're just going on their own, they're standing up for, I mean, this is really following your passion. I mean, this is really being true to yourself. You are just going with your intuition, your instincts. I know you have, there's funding for the thing, and this is a risk.
It's a risk, and I'm working with a very great company, Canal Plus, Le Studio Canal in France, who just believe in me enough anyway to let me find my way. And I don't know what other people how other people work. Like I said, this is a different way of working than I've ever done before, but it's pretty exciting.
Is it stressful?
And it's a hair stressful, Bobby, because I'm out there, in the boat, trying to get the idea for a paddle.
And you're hoping for that dog who smells the chocolate.
I'm hoping there's a chocolate shop around the corner.
Of the boat. We're going to unify these different analogies here. Because you got the boat and then you got the dog. No, it's beautiful. It's really a testimony to you, I mean, of anybody, here you are, really putting it out on the line to just absolutely follow your intuition and that your inner passions on a moment-to-moment basis, not really knowing what's next. And, okay, here's the last question that I have here, and if there's time, I have a couple of more, but Janet or Chris, you can tell me. I think we're finishing up about on time. What single idea, David, what single idea would you like to leave our listeners with tonight?
I think the idea would be world peace, because it doesn't matter what we love doing. If the world is, in turmoil, it really affects us in a negative way. And life, as Maharishi said, we're not meant to suffer. Our nature is bliss. And world peace is possible. It's so possible. And Maharishi has come up with a peace-creating group. The group is the key word, because it's several people doing a program together. They found is, as Dr. John Hagen says, quadratically more powerful than the same number scattered about. A peace-creating group, the square root of 1% of the world's population, which is 8,000, one supergroup of 8,000 peace-creating experts could bring peace to the whole world. This is worth, you know, doing. The groups on a smaller scale have been tested 52 times. All those tests have been independently verified as being successful in reducing crime and violence, two of the things that police and FBI measure. Every time it's tested, crime and violence in the area of the test go down. Other things go down, accidents, hospital visits, things that they can measure. They can't measure happiness going up, harmony going up, peace going up, but those things, I believe, happen. And if enough money can be raised to get this group on a permanent basis, we've got a brand new world. That is a real thing, and I'm working to try to get that money to put it on a permanent basis so there's peace on the world.
Well, I'm sure, Janet, you're going to have your own conclusion, but I would like to say that it has been an honor to throw out these questions, the best ones crafted by Chris Atwood, to throw out these questions and hear a real American Renaissance man, as Janet said, a real genius, and to hear your passions, David, and I'm talking right to you here as if I was in the room with you. You are a great genius. You have forged, I mean, in Britain, the Guardian newspaper called David, in a poll, the greatest film director in history. And you have forged new territory in your film, in your photography, in your music, in your cartooning. I made a grave mistake. I won't even go into that. About your furniture building. You just, unbelievable what you've done. And yet at the same time, well, not at the same time, all of that work that you've done has come from the deep core of your being. And yet you're not overshadowed by that work. You're still awake to the realization that you want to develop and foster and nurture and expand that inner core of your being, not only for yourself, but for children in the schools and for the whole world. And I see why you receive all these awards. I know why. I always adored you as a friend and as a partner on this path, and why Maharishi himself calls you Dr. David Lynch, because you really are an exponent and an expert of the truth of life in a way that can appeal to every human being of every culture and background and religion. So from my side, I want to thank Janet and Chris very, very much for giving me this opportunity to listen to David, listen to David's answers, and thank you, David, on behalf of all of us for who you are and what you're doing. So thank you.
Bless your heart, Bobby. Thank you very much, Bobby.
Janet?
Yes. Oh, and both of you. Just such a wonderful, wonderful, inspiring interview. And I apologize. I'm staying at a family's house in Kerala, and they all woke up at the same time. There's a big celebration here. And they all are in their rooms now waiting. So I just wanted to tell you, it was just so wonderful, Bobby and David, to be with both of you. And David, you know, I don't know if you know what I've been traveling all over India for the last 9 months off and on, interviewing great saints in India. And one thing that has become so clear, but always was, but now so, so clear, is that everything you said and more from my experience, I have been experiencing the great work that Maharishi Mahesh Yogi has been doing and is presently doing. And the project for permanent world peace that you were talking about, the collective consciousness, to me, that absolutely is the greatest, most important thing that any one of us can participate in. So I'm just so happy that you explained it all so concisely and clearly. And, you know, for me, what you represent is an individual who is so completely congruent with who you are. One of the things I say in my book is, you be you. You know, Mother Teresa, she did Mother Teresa so well, but no one else could do her as well as her, and no one else can do you as well as you, and you have really been doing you really outstandingly. And I just am so honored, as Bobby said, to be with you this evening and just to listen to your remarkable journey. And I know it probably hasn't always been easy because you're such a unique, which means that you have, you know, stood for what you believed in and walked ahead of what most people thought was the appropriate thing to do. So thank you so much, because truly, truly, to me, you are a very, very enlightened soul. So thank you, David. And Bobby, as always, being with you is just, what can I say, a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun.
Janet, I can tell that you are a very special person, and thank you very much for this show and opportunity.
Oh, you're so welcome. So for everyone on the call, I encourage you all to go to www.davidlynchfoundation.com. Again, www.davidlynchfoundation.com. This is a Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise exclusive, as this website has not even been publicly announced yet. But there you'll be able to read about the incredible work David is doing with students and the program he is supporting to make consciousness-based education available throughout the world. So thank you all for joining us this evening. I hope you enjoyed the rooster crowing in the background. I know you'll all want to join us again on July 19th when we interview Stephen Pierce. We'll get Stephen to tell us the story of how he went from a gang member dealing drugs to mega successful commodities trader and internet marketer. And all it took was a bullet that whizzed by his head and lodged itself in his thigh, where it remains today as a reminder of how far he has come. So this will be a remarkable interview, and I know everyone will want to join us. And again, thank you, David. I hope I have the honor to meet you someday, and Bobby, look forward to seeing you again. To all of you, until then, I'll open up all the lines and say goodnight. Let's say goodnight together. And again, put your attention on David's big intention, collectively. Hey.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.